Let's call this about Simon and Reuben. That's how our tradition usually refers to two people whose names we don't want to say directly. So let's call him Simon. He's the chief counsel, the lead counsel for a multinational corporation. I won't give you the name of the corporation, but it's a corporation that works in pharmaceuticals and chemistry. It's not Siemens. Not Siemens. One of the recent firms, this is a few years ago, one of the corporation's recent consumer products was liable for many deaths. Well, not many, but among them were Simon's nephews, Reuben's children. So the conglomerate, instead of apologizing the way Tylenol did and setting things straight after the cyanide incident in the 80s, sticks to their guns and claims that the death was due to willful misuse of one of their signature products. So Simon is duty-bound as lead counsel of the corporation to defend the corporation, the multinational. He says most of the products are good and helpful, and occasionally drugs go through testing periods and they prove ineffective or dangerous, and sometimes when you have a lot of good products, someone will misuse them, and the corporation can't be held liable when people misuse them not following the instructions. And that the several deaths among them, his nephews, were the exception sort of that proves the rule of the quality of their products. So Simon's brother Reuben is distraught, has no public comment about this, is kind of dumbfounded, both at the corporation's malfeasance, negligence, and that his brother could remain on as legal counsel of a corporation that had clearly mishandled things, to say the least. Now, one of the benefits of being a rabbi for 7 years is eventually you can retell stories and people forget that you told them before. So does anyone know what corporation that's about, who that's about? And remember that story? God. It's about God. Reuben and Simon are Moses and Aaron. And God would claim, Moshe would claim, you know, most of the things God does are good, as he does, I pointed out in the little teaching I had before the Torah service. Most of the things God does are good. God is validated through the glory of God's actions, and God is proven holy through those near to God. Of course, Aaron has nothing to say when his brother defends God rather than his own flesh and blood, which goes to a danger. You know, this is not material to where I want to go, but I think about this a lot. If we ever have to choose as Jews between defending God and protecting our fellow human being, protect the human. Human is much weaker than God, and God can withstand much more abuse than a human frame. So the corollary of Simon defending the corporation's guilt or malfeasance in the face of liability is what I called previously, or is called a tziduk hadin, a theodicy, a justification of God's overwhelming goodness in the face of apparent evil grief, the suffering of the righteous. And the corollary, of course, of Reuven's silence in the story is Aaron's silence. Aaron's inability to process what's going on. Aaron's inability, I think, to validate Moses' claims and God's righteousness at that moment. He does so through another act I'll refer to in just a moment. But he also finds himself, or is told to be, incapable of mourning. God warns Aaron, don't mourn your sons. It will throw the people into chaos. It will bring them into rended grief. They will not be able to support or understand what's going on. They will maybe lose faith. So Hiskuni, the 13th century French rabbi, notes the commonality with this, where Ezekiel is described to being told by God after the death of the prophet's wife, moan softly, but do not observe public rituals. I think maybe implied in that is an inability to change what's done. As we see with David, after the death of a son, he says, you know, I, I can't mourn anymore. There's nothing I can do. It's past. Maybe. Grief is very powerful. I think Aaron knows something else, though, that Aaron doesn't specifically state, but maybe is accused of God, accused to God in the silence, accused to his brother in the silence, that Reuben would accuse his brother, the lead counsel, in the silence. Death doesn't always have a purpose. That we don't always understand, or there doesn't seem to be, or maybe there just isn't, a pattern in the world. That the good are not rewarded, the wicked are not punished, that things, sometimes there's a reason for things, but sometimes that reason is just random probability. That's what my colleague said. I think Aaron knows that, and that's a piece of his silence, yet he knows he can't change the decree. It's too late, it's ineffective, so he just remains silent. Our rabbis teach in the Talmud that four people were known to have died through the counsel of the serpent, which is to say, when Adam and Eve took the counsel of the serpent, they introduced life and death into the world. There was mortality for the first point. And there are at least four people, say our sages, who died only because of mortality. There was no cause and effect to their death. And they name them as Benjamin, Jacob's son, Amram, who was the father of Moses, Jesse, the father of David, and Kilav, who is son of David. Those are just people we know of who appear to have no noticeable flaw or problem. I think Aaron knows that. I think Aaron knows that not all events in God's world are God's providence. And I would say I don't believe in God's providence, but Aaron at least understands, as did our sages in Talmud, that there is a limit to God's providence, that God's providence is not in application or in force at all moments. And he cries out in silence. Art Green quotes one of the Hasidic masters as saying that outcry is valuable whether before or after the judgment. Which is to say, he knows he can't change anything, and yet being dumbstruck, or as I pointed out earlier, maybe even crying and then being dumbstruck, is a response, an important response. But Aaron does something that challenges the status quo, that challenges fatalism, that challenges the belief that everything is preordained. He's offered the food of the sacrifice, and he refuses to partake. So there's a little context for that that we don't understand in our modern world, perhaps. There's a concept called theistai, and my ancient Greek is rusty in that I never studied ancient Greek, but it's certainly rusty at the very least, so I may not be pronouncing it correctly, but it meant fellowship, meal table fellowship with the deity. That when we describe our priests as eating of the holy rites, of eating as the sacrifices, that was a way of them sharing a meal with the deity, which was experienced more literally in Exodus when Moses and the elders go up and have a meal with God. So Aaron's response is sort of, not today, God. I can't eat with you today. There's a lot of rebellion, subtle rebellion. You know, if you live in a dictatorship, hard to rebel. Someone taught me very recently, we just recently had Palm Sunday for our Christian brethren, and do you know what the palms were? This was very interesting to me. The palms were a small and significant signal of resistance to the Roman Empire. It was a way of sort of, pardon the French, giving them the middle finger when they walked by, because you couldn't out and out object. You couldn't out and out lead rebellion. You'd be crushed. The Roman Empire was too mighty. So I think this, you know, I'm not going to take a meal with you, God, and I'm going to be silent when I should praise, is as far as Aaron can go, understanding God's might and fearing God's will. So Aaron senses the limits of action. Aaron senses the limits of one's capacity, and yet the knowledge that one must act as possible, which brought to mind the Serenity Prayer, common in 12-step circles, and sometimes attributed to the Union Theological Seminary and Reinhold Niebuhr. I always thought was German, but it was an American born with a very Germanic name. So, of course, the intro, the first stanza of that prayer is, God grant me the serenity to accept the things I cannot change, courage to change the things I can, and wisdom to know the difference. Serenity, courage, and wisdom, that we should all have those things. So Aaron is stuck in a place of wisdom that leads him to some form of serenity eventually. And I think by contrast, slightly, on the other side of that fence is David in the Haftarah. So the Haftarah is roughly this sequence of events. God's name gets attached to the ark, where previously it had been circulating and peregrinating among the tribes in a processional. Each tribe would get it for a certain period, let's say. We see that Uzzah accidentally touches the ark, much in parallel, in counterpart to the way that Nadav and Avihu are crushed by coming too close. He dies. They recognize that the ark is too valuable to be afraid of, too powerful, too important, so they celebrate the ark as it processes to Jerusalem. Partly, notes the Eitz Chaim Chumash as a way of dedicating the capital in Jerusalem to indicate to everyone that they are there. And then my favorite moment, they make raisin cakes, so I sort of picture everyone getting a Danish. That's like, everyone gets a raisin. I mean, that's a Danish. It's a Danish they get. So everyone gets a little Danish, which, you know, Jews still do. And David dances. David dances, Rafe says, maybe undulates, maybe he whirls and twirls. And he notices when Michal accuses him, says, you know, you're being ridiculous. He says, it's not ridiculous to love God, and clearly I have been chosen over your father Saul, so I can do what I want. Problematically, we hear that from certain political leaders now, like, what I do is clearly ethical because I won. That's been said recently. But for David, maybe it's a little more true. And then David, in chapter 7, which is not part of the Sephardic Haftarah, interestingly, asks God, he says, God, you've been wandering around so long. First it was the tabernacle, now it's this ark, and we have to process it from place to place. Wouldn't you like to settle down? Can't we make for you a home in my new capital of Jerusalem? And at first it sounds like it's a good idea, and then Nathan says, not yet. God doesn't want to yet. God can't be held down, but Solomon will be able to do it. David wants to do something. David also, like Aaron, recognizes the limits of human control over life, and perhaps in David's version of the Serenity Prayer, whereas Aaron would have said the Serenity Prayer, and the Serenity would be, I can't change what's happened, but I have the courage to at least speak to God in some sort of oblique way. David notices, okay, I can't build you a court here, not yet, but God, you've granted me that I will have a dynasty, and I will eventually build you the temple. And in the meantime, what I can do is dance and celebrate and give everyone Danish. We choose what we can do. We have to recognize the limits of our own control in the institutions in which we serve, in our own families, in our own lives. You only get so many years. You know, the psalmist says 70 years, 80 if you are strong, to grow, to learn about yourself, to become better, to become more fluid and fluent in one's career, in one's life, in one's human interactions. So you work on what you can. You work on the low-hanging fruit. You let yourself be a little flawed. You have the serenity to accept even the parts of yourself that you're not going to get to this lifetime. And you let yourself have the serenity to accept that at work, with your boss, with your kids, some people can't change, some things can't change very fast, and that's a challenge. And you have to have the courage, like David, like Aaron, to know, to change what you can, to poke at, to pry with what crowbars you have available. And then the trick in life is to know which one is which, to know which one you have control over and which you don't. My rabbi and I used to have a lot of debates when I was his intern. You know, Dan, you should wield your authority more heavy-handedly. I'm sure you could do more at the synagogue than you do, change more, affect more. And he says, it's not as easy as you think. And when I got to a pulpit myself, I realized he was right. So it's just the nature of things. They're less malleable than you think, and the world has more inertia and momentum than we do. My dad used to point that out as a matter of physics. Just inertia and momentum are contained in the world because it has so much mass, and your mass is very small. Can't change the momentum of the earth. You can change small things. So my wish for you is both serenity in the things you can't change, courage where you have effective power, and wisdom not to tear yourself up because you don't understand the difference.